It's chapter 3, verse 8. This was right after Haman decides he wants to destroy the Jews. So Haman speaks to the king, and he says to him, there is a nation that's far-flung and widespread. Ibn Ezra on that point says that it means they can't even work together as a unit. Each one, like as an individual, each one works by himself. In other words, sometimes you have different groups, but at least the group is a coherent group. This, they're so separated that they cannot work as a group, okay? And therefore, what's the good of having them, okay? That was one of the arguments. The question that we ask is, what Haman say about the Jews? Is it true or is it not true? Are we that type of people or are we not that type of people? Can we work together or not? That is the question. In other words, when somebody tells you off, there's two ways of dealing with it. Either you react and you're angry with the person, or you ask the question, did I do something wrong and can I do something about it? Okay? There's two ways of taking a criticism. Now, this is a criticism of the Jew. Now, I want to know, this criticism is a correct criticism or a non-correct criticism? According to, again, the question is, according to the Ibn Ezra, when he says, when Haman said to Ahasuerus, that the nation of Israel is mefuzel meforad, far-flung and widespread, the Ibn Ezra says that it means that we can't operate as a unit. We operate in, you know, like individuals or small groups. We can't get together as a unit. And therefore, you can't work with them because you can't work with them because each group is different than the other. You see? So the question is this true or not? That is the question. Is it a lie or is it really an insight into the nature of the Jew? I would like to ask another question. The question is what makes a group cohesive? When you have a group that works together, what causes them to be a cohesive group? There are two things that make a cohesive group. One is fear, and one is ideas. Rationale dictates that we should work together. Okay, there's a rational reason why we should work together. Like for instance, in civilization, we work together, so then we can make a lot of things and work together. Each one does his job good, so we work together. We have a civilization. If each one works by themselves, everybody has to start from scratch, build everything on their own, so it's going to be a harmful thing. That's a rational reason why we should work together. But there's also a certain fear. I'll explain. Let's say, for instance, you're in a group, right? Now, that group tolerates very little being different. Let's say, for instance, they laugh at somebody and you feel it's unjust. And you're going to tell them that it's unjust. It's not right that you laugh at them. And that you laugh at that person. They won't accept you in the group anymore. If you're going to tell them Musa, if you're going to try to correct them, they're not going to accept you in the group. In a family, right? In certain families, they give you a certain amount of leeway where you could deviate a certain amount. But beyond that, you know what I mean? Like, for instance, there are certain people that the children are murderers and they still stick by them. You know what I mean? Still a family. If they would change their religion, that's it, they're out. You understand? Like, there's all different types. To be in a group, you must have some boundaries to be in the group. Okay? And the greatest fear is of not being in a group. There's a very great fear of being separated from the group. You see? So therefore, what keeps you part of the group is fear. Like, for instance, in the time of Haman, Haman is talking all the other people were cohesive. Each one in their own group was at least cohesive. Why? Because it was based on some religion, and religion is a terrible, terrible fear. It's a fear of reality of certain things in the physical world you're afraid of, and therefore you want to be part of the group so that God should help you. So you create a God that will protect you. You see? Okay? So therefore, like for instance, there's a woman, she told me she was a some denomination of Christian, and she always used to go to the study group with the priest, and the priest, you know, he's telling about religion, and she never read the Bible. Suddenly one day she decided she wanted to read the Bible, and she read the Bible. I don't know if it was the Torah or the Testament, but the thing is that she started asking questions, and they said, no, you can't ask any questions. And then when she continued asking questions, they said, well, if you continue asking questions, you can't be part of the church. We're going to throw you out of the church. They don't accept any type of... it's a certain line that you must keep. If you're going to go to heaven and God is going to protect you in this world, you must stick to what we say in the group. Or not, you're out of the group. You see? So therefore, in most cases, there is a strong fear... there that keeps you attached. Okay? However, in Torah, the purpose of Torah is that we should create an independent thinker. I'll show you that even if you hold that Torah is not an independent thinker, like you look at it like a religion of that you must obey everything, the facts are different because in law, there's the machlokas. I think somebody one time said that if you go through all the machlokas and about tefillin, all the different arguments on tefillin, you would have 64 different types of pairs of tefillin. Okay? So you see, it's not one way. Within the system. Within the very system. I mean... And also, in the hashkafa, philosophy of Torah, you also find different views. That they had different philosophies, which changed the way your whole outlook, each one, whichever philosophy you partake of, is going to be a different outlook on life. So even if you don't hold from being an independent thinker by just studying Torah, by just seeing all the different views, so there's a sense that there's, in other words, like many times people say, why are you different than all the other people that hold differently than you, Rabbi Moskowitz? It's just different, they're different authority. I mean, I hold that you should accept authority, but then understand with your own mind why you accept it. But you have to accept an authority. But other people might hold that you just accept an authority. You don't have to have a reason. But though I could quote my authorities, they'll quote their authorities. Okay? But within the religion, both are acceptable. The women of Shammai, who was more strict than the women of Hillel, so the women of Shammai would borrow pots and pans from Hillel. And the women of Hillel would say, this pot you can borrow because that's okay according to Shammai. But this one, we're allowed to use because Hillel permits, but you're not allowed to use it because Shammai does not permit. And they would tell them they work together as a unit, even though they're independent thinkers. An independent thinker can tolerate another person's view. You understand? And therefore we could be cohesive, even though we have different views, if you're an independent thinker. It's not a hatred or an anger. You have a different view. We'll argue our views out until one of us is right, or we'll walk away friends, and that's it. So therefore I want to say like this, that by the Jews, there are a few independent thinkers, and they will be cohesive because they understand they could accept another person's point of view. But however, there are a lot of people that are not an independent thinker, and they accept it on an emotional level, and they say, my way is right and your way is wrong. And so because the very system wants you to be an independent thinker, so therefore when you're not an independent thinker and you look at the system, so that causes divisiveness and arguments among the different groups, right? Like you walk into a synagogue. I mean, the arguments are, The guy doesn't know what he's talking. I mean, it's really like an anger. Each group takes his own idea. Or, for instance, like a student and a teacher. The student can look at it his way. The teacher looks at it his way. There's no getting together in trying to understand the other person's point of view. You see? So the Torah tells us to be independent. And yet, if we're not an independent thinker, then I take it emotionally where I feel that I'm right and you're wrong. You see? But therefore, I think Haman was right by the nature of what God wants to get Klal Yisrael to be, that each one should come to the basic conclusions of Torah based on ideas. That would be good if the whole nation was involved in the world of learning. Then we'd have a very good system. You see, like at the time of Shlomo, everybody was involved in learning. So it was a good system. They could work together. But once you have Torah and you work based on your emotions and your feelings, so that independence causes divisiveness among each other. You see? So therefore I hold that Haman was really right when he was talking about the Jew, that they are divisive and they can't, and it's very hard for them to work together. Maybe small groups, but they can't work together. The question is that even Judaism has a certain line where we will not accept you as part of the group. Okay? Like, for instance, the Rambam says that a person that accepts the 13 Animamas, but because of his passion, because of powerful emotions or addictions, he cannot keep the mitzvahs, you still must accept them as a part of Klal Yisrael, and you must have all the laws of a Jew, you must apply to him. But if there is a person that refuses to accept, he does not have a conviction about the 13 animamins, the 13 basic principles of faith, so then you don't relate to him that way. So you see that we also have boundaries in where we accept a person, where we don't accept a person. The thing is, I'd like to explain there's a difference here. In all other groups, the decision is based on my emotions. And therefore, and if you cannot identify, if I cannot identify with you, I cannot relate to you, I can't keep you in the group. It's a matter of an unconscious feeling that somehow you and I are equal or the same. You see? But once I feel you're different, then I can't tolerate you. You're different. You see? It's a similar idea of bigotry. You see, you're different, I can't relate to you. But in Torah, there's a different reason. There's a value system. Let's say, for instance, I don't want to hang around with a murderer. That's not because a murderer. I don't want to hang around with a murderer. Why? Okay. It's not because of bigotry or some emotion. It's a practical thing. I don't want to be hurt, or I don't want to learn his ways. Well, start acting like him. You see, one of the two, either he will hurt me because he is a murderer, so he could hurt me, or two, I'll see his ways and I might start feeling maybe I could carve an outlet for my aggression. What's the big deal? And after a while, I'll learn from him and start doing it. So to protect myself, I don't hang around with him, so I have to draw a boundary. You see? So there's an irrational way of drawing a boundary, and there's a rational way. But the rational way of drawing a boundary is very different than the irrational way. And even how I relate to these people, it's all based on a certain truth that I must hold. Like, for instance, let's say somebody gets the death penalty, right? That's because God said that he is harmful to civilization, and this person will break down civilization, and therefore you have a responsibility to remove him from society. So therefore I rely on God that when he tells me who I should get rid of in society. You see? But it's based on a reality. Then logically I could see why he holds that. Why God wants me to keep it that way. You see? And the thing is, there's also a difference in other people's religion and their relationship to God, an idolater's relationship to God and a Jewish relationship to God. Okay? An idolater's relationship to God, he looks at God as some authority which he must obey. Okay? We look at God as the source of all reality. In other words, God is the creator, and he is the source of all reality. Being in line with God is being in line with reality. It's a different view of the religion. It's a different view of the way you view life. If you really see that idea clearly, that your relationship to God is very different than the idolatrous view of God. An idolatrous view of God, we look at an authority, I must obey. With or without thinking, I must obey. We say, no, God is the source of all reality, and I want to live in line with reality, because living in line out of reality is harmful. So if he's the source of all reality, when he tells me halacha, that's reality. Even though I can't prove it from the physical world, that is reality because he is the source of all reality. Therefore, I obey him based on reality as the source of reality, which is a totally different view, totally different view of the whole system of religion. It's a totally different view, those two aspects. David wants to say that the fact of anybody that holds from free will must also hold from being an independent thinker. Of course, if you're not an independent thinker, then you don't have your own free will. Just following something else without thought, or somebody else without thought. So therefore, where's the free will? Free will means that I have a choice, I can make different decisions. You see? So therefore, I must be an independent thinker to make that. But if I'm not an independent thinker, so then how could I have free choice? It's a good point. Okay, we're going to do Mishlei. It's Proverbs chapter 28, verse 3. And it says like this. A poor person that robs from the poor. It uses two different terms for poor. The first person is extremely poor, and he robs from somebody that is poor that has some money. He is like rain water that is flooding, right? The rain is so heavy that it floods, and there is no bread. In other words, Rush is extremely poor, Dal is not so poor, okay? And the Rush steals from the Dal, right? That is equal to rain water that is flooding. It's so heavy, the rain, that it's flooding. The Ein Lachem, and there is no bread. There are two questions that we have to ask. One question is that stealing brings consequences. Why does he have to, why don't you just say if a person steals, they'll get consequences, which he said throughout his book. Why is he so particular about this one person? In other words, he's excluding the poor from the rich from the rich, and the rich from the poor. He's excluding all that, okay? And he's only talking about this one particular case, and he'll say he'll get consequences. And two, when he tells me the consequences, he's telling me that flood water wipes out the grains and there will be no bread. That's basically what he's saying, right? Why does he have to tell me a metaphor? Let him tell me he'll get consequences. What is the metaphor teaching me that I wouldn't know if he just told me the consequences of whatever the consequences are? Why does he have to mention the metaphor? Besides which, what does the metaphor mean? I mean, basically it means that the consequences, he will not get what he wanted. He will not get the bread. When ultimately he wants bread, he will not get that bread. Okay? As a result of his stealing. Right. That's the consequence. But that's the consequences of all stealing. You see? So if he wants to tell me about stealing, so let him just say stealing and tell me what the consequences are. Why does he have to tell me this Rush, extreme poor, steals from Dalim, who's not so poor, and that the consequences is, he tells me, in a metaphor, it's like flood water, like overpowerful rains that causes floods, and therefore it wipes everything out. Why don't you just tell me what the consequences are? That's it. That I won't have any. I won't get what I wanted. Again, the two questions. One question is why is King Solomon so particular about a poor stealing from the poor, the rush from the doll? Okay? Why is he so particular about that? Why didn't you say stealing bring consequences? Okay? And then when he tells the consequences, say he won't have what he wanted originally. And you go back to many other psukim where it tells the consequences of stealing. You see? And two, why does he use this metaphor? Very nice metaphor. It's like flood water that you don't get any bread. Fine, the floods wipe out the thing and there's no bread. What did he add with the flood water? Let him say he won't get any bread. What is he adding with that? That's two questions. There are two types of crooks. There's one type of crook that thinks it out. Intelligent person, he thinks it out. And he'll rob jewelry, he'll rob rich, he'll rob many people. Then there are certain people that they just rob immediately out of desperation. They're desperate, so they rob, but they're not really crooks. Now, they cannot go to, first of all, to a place that's protected, because they're not prepared for that. And also, the odds are that they will, when a rich person is robbed, so then the police are politically, so the police will take care of him faster than the poor, you see? So, in desperation, when you're in desperate needs, you go to the easiest mark and the closest mark where you will not have you'll not have too many problems. And it's not a planned out thing. Like, for instance, a person that robs a car that they strip them down, they know how to rob the car, even if it has the best equipment on it. They're trained to either bypass the equipment or take it apart so fast that they're gone before anybody comes, right? That's trained criminals. This guy is not a trained criminal, okay? He's desperate, and he's just stealing for bread. That's why at the end he says he will not have bread. Doesn't say he will not be wealthy. A rich person, a real crook, wants to be wealthy. So it says, I'll go for wealth, and he won't have that wealth. Somehow he'll lose that on the wealth, based on consequences, you see? But the thing is, here we're talking about a person that's desperate. All he wants is bread. Okay? That answers the first question, why he robs from the poor. Because the poor don't have protection. They don't have alarm systems. They don't have police protection too much. Many times there's corruption. The question is, what about when the rich steal from the poor? The rich steal from the poor. They steal from the poor for different reasons. It's not out of desperation. Then why they steal from the poor, there's many psukim that deal with that. Maybe there's a certain, they can't tolerate that anybody has something. Very wealthy people cannot, it's not money anymore, they can't tolerate that somebody has something. It's like a jealousy that I can't tolerate. But he could think it out. It's not desperation, it's an emotion. Here we're talking about physical desperation. He needs food. He needs food. He's desperate. Okay? It's a different type of situation. This is the situation that King Solomon is setting up. In other words, we haven't answered the question why this is out of the category of stealing. Whatever the cause is, whether I'm stealing because I'm a kleptomaniac, if I'm stealing because I'm jealous, I can't tolerate when anybody owns something, or I'm stealing because I can't, my greed will not let me stop. Whatever the emotion is, the consequences are the same. So let him just say stealing. We haven't answered that. All we showed was what is this particular thing talking, the quality of the particular thing. We defined the quality of this particular thing as desperation. A rush is extremely poor, and he steals from the poor, and why he doesn't, and we explained why he doesn't go to the rich. You see? Because that's complicated already. You have to work out alarm systems, you have to, you know what I mean? You have to be careful of many different things. Poor person, the police are not going to put in the same energy. I mean, in a corrupt society anyway. I mean, as they're not going to put in the same energy as a poor person as a rich person in a lot of cases. I wouldn't say every society. But the fact is that we're talking about a desperate person. Desperate person. But we haven't answered the other questions. We haven't answered the metaphor, and we haven't answered why is this not part of stealing. Let it just incorporate it as a part of stealing, another motive for stealing. It's a particular. In other words, for stealing, there are many, many consequences. You rob from one person, even if he's not a poor person, he's going to feel if he could get away, like with taxes. The person steals, and he gets away with taxes, so then he feels that if everybody's doing it, why shouldn't I do it? That's like a license. So that destroys society. With all stealing destroys society, there's many different ways that stealing destroys you, that it's throughout the book. I mean, that it destroys society, destroys yourself. There's many things about stealing that there are different consequences that he talks about throughout the book. Why did he have to particularize in this particular case? Okay. It doesn't use the term flood. It uses the term rain, too much rain. Why does he do that? See, because rain is good. Rain is good. It's the quantity of rain that's no good. You understand? Too little or too much is no good. There's a certain in-between that's perfect for growing. Too much means that you destroy everything you have. Whatever you do, if it was too little, you wouldn't get anything. He's going to get the bread, you see, but the flood will wipe it away. You see what I mean? So the thing is that we're talking about that the in other words, the same thing is money is good, but it's the way you get the money represents, the metaphor represents the way you get the money. Okay? So therefore, getting money is good, just like rain is good. A person needs money because he needs bread. But the way he does it, that is, brings about consequences. Okay? So the metaphor is telling this person that you should not steal, but you should get money in a regular way, in a just way. Okay? Now, that is what the metaphor is saying. And again I say, even though that is what the metaphor is saying, it still does not answer the question, what is he telling me this for? This is by all stealing. There are consequences. But at least the metaphor is explained, and when he says there is no bread, is because we're talking about a rush, an extremely poor person. Extremely poor. So if the person is extremely poor, all he wants is bread, right? And we say he'll get the same consequence as any other crook. So the question is, so why does he tell me that? Why does he tell me that? Why doesn't he tell me about, stealing in general? Why does he talk about this particular case? That's what we have to answer. The thing is, most of the times when the emotions look at evil, they look at a person that his desire is evil. This person is not evil, he's desperate. He's desperate. And therefore, I might say, well look, he couldn't help himself. This guy can't help himself, he's desperate. You see? Desperate is not an excuse for going against nature or justice. You understand? If you are on the top of the mountain and you're dying of hunger, and 3 days down is food, if you jump, you're desperate, you're still going to die. Desperate is no excuse. You cannot go against the laws of nature. You cannot go against justice. Desperate is not an excuse. Give me an example. What? Say, let's say. To broaden this out, let's say, for instance, a person gives up smoking, right? And he starts, his need for a cigarette becomes extremely great. He becomes desperate. So he'll say, all I'll have is one. That's all I'll have is one cigarette. I'll have a half a cigarette. All I need is one puff. That's all I need. That's it. It's over with. Once you, desperation does not remove reality. That's what he's saying. He's saying desperation does not remove reality. You see? You must know. I'm not saying sometimes desperation, there would be things you could do. There's things you could do in desperation, maybe. I don't know. But it has to be within reality. If it's outside of reality, desperation will kill you. You know, they have a saying, added a frying pan into the fire. Like if somebody's in a, as a metaphor, somebody's in a frying pan and it's burning, like he's desperate, so he jumps out any which way he can, and he jumps right into the fire, which is worse. Desperation could lead you to destruction. If you have a feeling, I have to have something, don't make the decision in a desperate mood, because that decision could affect the rest of your life. Desperation, that's what he's saying, desperation. Let's put it this way, I'll go the opposite. If you constantly fight desperation and always make a logical decision, even when you're desperate, that will help you reach the level of Rabbi Akiva, where he's tortured to death and he still doesn't give in. He still accepts God under torture. There's absolutely no doubt in his mind. That is because throughout his life, he was always guided by truth and ideas. He never lets desperation make a decision. This is not an evil person. We're not talking about evil. We're talking about desperate. You see? And many times we say, well, look, he couldn't help himself. And you're right. When I'm looking at a desperate person and he makes the decision, I feel bad for him. He's not evil. But the fact is, he will have the consequences. He will have the consequences of his life. That's a reality. You understand? I might not even condemn him. I'd say, look, he couldn't help himself. But the fact is that he made a move into an area that is against reality. And he will pay the consequences like anybody else. Even if the motive was wrong, he will pay the consequences. That's what the verse is coming to tell us. Okay, clarification of how it relates back to the Pasuk. The Pasuk is talking about the poorest of people. He's desperate, right? He can only grab, he's not a professional, so he may, out of desperation, he steals something from a person that's not as poor, that has something. He doesn't have anything. He steals from somebody that has something. Okay? That's desperation, you see? Now, we say that even when you're desperate, that is no excuse for going the wrong way. In other words, let's say, for instance, there's a drought. Flood water will not help the drought. That will not help it. We need water, but too much is no good. Whatever you say, too much is no good. So it's saying the same thing, that even out of desperation, you will have the same consequences as a crook. A person that's evil, even though you're not evil. You see? You're desperate. Don't use desperation as an excuse to go against reality. Even like the Rabbi Akiva, he's being tortured to death. He's desperate. He will not let desperation make a decision for him. That's the idea of Pasuk. The thing is that the question is that if he's desperate, they could rob from the rich too. The answer is when a person is desperate, he can't think a thing out. And he's not, this guy is not a criminal, so he's going to grab from whoever is close by to him, that's close by to him right now. You see? So therefore he's going to grab from another poor person he lives in the neighborhood. But to go out of the neighborhood, that's not desperation already. That's already thinking it through. You see? When you started out with the pasuk, everybody thought that the subject was stealing. You see, that's why we constantly ran into the problem. But really the truth is the subject is desperation. Is desperation a mater or a license to do evil? That's the question, you see? And he even gave desperation in a real physical problem that the guy is so poor he doesn't have what to eat, you see? How much more so with desperation is emotional. Somebody insults you and all your emotions at the spur of a moment, you just want to let it out that time, and you do something, react evilly. You react according to evil, you see? So the thing is that's the subject. Subject is desperation. Subject is not stealing. So the question is what is it? The question is, what is the metaphor addressing? Okay, that is the question. Why do you mention? Why do you put the metaphor? The metaphor is telling you that there are two ways of doing right or wrong. There's two ways. One is reality, and one is not reality. And the reason why he's telling me that here again is to show me that desperation is no excuse to go against reality. You see, that's what it's emphasizing. It's emphasizing that there are two ways of relating to results. One way is a positive way. One way is against reality. And so therefore, it's emphasizing these two ways and saying desperation is not an excuse to do the wrong thing. We're doing Proverbs chapter 28, verse 4. Ozvei Torah, he who leaves Torah, Yahalelu Rasha, the wicked praise. B'shomrei Torah, and those that guard Torah, Yizgoru Bam, argue with them. Okay? Now, so there are three people that we're dealing with. We're dealing with those that leave Torah, that he calls Ozvei Torah, right? Then we're dealing with the Rasha, and we're dealing with the Shomrei Torah, those that keep Torah. Okay? So the wicked praises the person that leaves Torah, and those that guard Torah argue with them. Okay? Now, the question is, first of all, who does he argue with? Okay? Now, according to the grammar, the first half of the pasuk, Ozvei Torah, is plural. The ones that leave Torah, they use the term plural. Rasha, singular. So the plural must be with the Ozvei Torah. Okay? We have to ask, why doesn't the Shomrei Torah, those that guard Torah, why don't they argue with the wicked? Okay? That's the first question. And the second question that we have to answer, who are the wicked? And we must define it according to the pasuk. We have lots of definitions of Russia. But however, every pasuk deals with a different aspect, and they're defining a different aspect of Russia. Okay? So what we want to know is what is the aspect of Russia that we are defining in this case, okay? And in it we must explain why the Shomrei Torah, those that guard Torah, won't even bother arguing with them. That is the question. In other words, the Russia, King Solomon uses a particular aspect. The Russia praises the person that leaves Torah. Okay? Now the question is, who is the Russia and what's the definition of Russia? There are, in other words, a wicked person senses, an evil person that doesn't accept Torah based on emotional reasons, there's a certain sense that he feels that he's doing the wrong thing. There's a certain sense of doing the wrong thing. Okay? Most people realize, unconsciously, they won't admit it consciously, but there's a feeling of, it was an interesting experiment. There was the scientist that liked cowboy movies, and he was the head scientist, and the guys that he worked with in research went to cowboy movie with him. They said in every cowboy movie, the wicked always loses on the draw. So he bought toy guns for everybody, and he designated a certain group as the wicked and a certain group as the righteous. Okay? And he says, most of the time, the righteous always outdrew the wicked. There's a certain sense of guilt that stops you. Like even being designated as evil, like it brings out that part of you that, and the guy made an experiment like many, many times. He was a scientist, and he made a lot of these experiments. So it shows that sometimes when you call a person evil, even if he's not really evil, there's a certain part of him that still might feel the guilt. You understand? And that guilt brings him, sends him back, brings him, makes it harder for him. That guilt, he's in conflict. You see? The question is, not always. That happens to be true. Not always. And we'll discuss that a little bit later. Okay? So therefore, the wicked person, the way the pasuk is looking at the wicked person, there's certain wicked people, when they sense that they are wrong, only those wicked people that sense that they're wrong, they must have society. The proof that they're right is the more people they have on their side is they're right. In other words, like by Haman, the whole world bowed down to Haman except one person. Why should it make a difference, one person? But that one person was enough to break the armor around his ego, around his sense that he's doing the wrong thing. He had to protect himself. The only way he protects himself is he must have 100% people around him. See, different religions, false religions, they must force people to accept their religion. You see why? Because if there's somebody that doesn't accept their religion, that is a break in their armor. That they sense that there's something wrong. You see? That's why, especially the Jew, because the Jew is the biggest breakdown of all religions, the existence of the Jew. That's why it becomes very important to hate the Jew and to try to destroy the Jew by other religions, because they sense that we are right and they are wrong, and the only way to take away that doubt is to totally destroy the Jew. That is the type of wicked person that we're talking about. And therefore he praises a person that gives up. He's happy and excited and praises a person that gives up the Torah. You understand? That is the first step that we have. That's the Rasha, the definition of the Rasha according to this pasuk. That he is caught. There are, we'll soon discuss other types of wicked people, but the thing is, the most wicked people sense that they're wrong. There's a certain sense, and they need groups of people around them. They say that Hitler used to stay up at night. He couldn't sleep at night. And they used to stand. He used to stand around with the greatest, the top guys in his, the top Nazis in the field, that were close to him. They used to talk how great they are, and stand around and pat each other on the back. And they had very weak egos, and they constantly needed each other's acceptance of each other and how great they are and how important they are, because there was a sense, there's a weakness in their ego, and they have to constantly, by either forcing others to accept them or by having people accept them. One of the two, they must get rid of anybody that disagrees, because that breaks the armor that protects their ego. When somebody disagrees with them, it's very frightening to them. Therefore, it's a big hatred of the Jew because of that. And you see, great thinkers were also hated by tyrants. They hated them. Great thinkers hated tyrants. I mean, tyrants hated great thinkers. Okay? Because that was the breakdown in their cover-up. Now, those that leave Torah, and I'm accepting Torah that they're leaving the truth. Okay? There's an interesting guy. There was a guy by the name of Darwin. Okay? And he was he was very religious. He was, I don't know if he's Catholic or Protestant, whatever he was very religious. He went to seminary. studying to be the priesthood when he got involved in biology and started to study his theory, and then he became an atheist. So they asked him a question, did he have any conflict when he became an atheist? Like when he left the religion, did he have any conflict? He says no. He said no. Why? He says because his mind was on the ideas, he was following the ideas, and the ideas naturally affected his emotions, that he didn't accept religion anymore based on the ideas. You see? That type of person, if he gives up religion, will not have conflict. He will not have to praise anybody that leaves religion. He doesn't have to praise a person that left the religion. He doesn't care. It's simply, look, I see the truth. You want to accept it? Fine. You don't. You see? The only question is he rational or not? Does it make sense? You see? I think a person like that, if a wise scholar of Torah would argue with him, I think he would be able to see the truth. You see? Same thing with Einstein. Einstein did not accept, it was very hard for him to accept the personal God. Why couldn't he accept the personal God? Because his view of a personal God was God deals with you personally, and his idea of God was a result of a certain evil, and yet we're also in the laws of nature, and where one comes in and where the other goes out is based also on a system. I think that it would be possible for Einstein to accept such an idea. It's possible. I don't know. I mean, it is possible he had a powerful emotion against anything but the laws of nature, and there was a personal emotion. That is possible. You understand? But I don't know. But I'm just saying thinkers are guided by a totally different thing, and even there, and if somebody holds something different, it doesn't bother them. Einstein used to go and like to listen to people that used to argue against his theory. He never defended himself. He wasn't defensive about it. He was just going to listen. He would just like to listen, but he wouldn't even bother correcting them. He just enjoyed listening to their arguments. I guess in his own mind, he thought of the answers and worked it out. But he didn't interfere with the lecture. He didn't argue. He was just interested in truth, and that's it. And he would follow the argument. That's it. That's a thinker, you see. That is not the type of person that we're talking about, Osvei Torah. We're not talking about that type of person. Osvei Torah, that type of person, you need a logical thinker to train him in thought. Osvei Torah is a person in conflict. When you first start leaving Torah, there is a conflict. There's something still there, so therefore you could still talk to the person. He's not closed-minded to the argument. If he is, then you reach a point where you got to stop arguing. But the Shomrei Torah recognizes that he can be reached. They don't. In other words, these are not stupid people that they go out and preach to the world. It's with Chachma they make distinctions who they could. It's a matter of who you could reach and who you can't reach. It's with Chachma that they make decisions. The Rasha you can't reach. He's totally closed-minded. He's battling his conflict. Maybe you could help him by explaining his conflict. Maybe. But most of the time, they're all closed. At a certain point, he makes a decision that he's closed. Another person might be open-minded. He's in conflict. That's the Osvei Torah. You have to know the difference between the two, who you're going to argue with. You see? So the thing is, as a result of this pasuk, there are a few different people. There are people that leave the good life, the life of justice and truth. Even a non-Jewish person leaves the life of justice and truth, and his emotions close off, and his hatred of anybody that represents justice and truth, he hates them. And he's happy when a person leaves the life of justice and truth, or Torah. Okay? Person that is leaving Torah, person that is leaving justice and truth, based on Chachma, then you must win him over totally with Chachma. The Osvei Torah,
The ones that are leaving because of emotional reasons, sometimes you have to argue with them logically. Sometimes you have to show them which emotions are moving them away, that you have to use chachma to talk with them. And the Shomrei Torah, the ones that guard Torah, means that there's a certain level of chachma. They make a distinction who they can help and who they can't. It's not just crazy to go out to try to turn over the whole world. It's just a matter of chachma. This guy I can protect, this guy I can't protect, that's all. It's a matter of practicality. Who I could reach, who I could help, and who I cannot help. Certain doctors have to make decisions in the physical world. There's a certain point they say, look, we cannot help you. You're better off enjoying the rest of your life, whatever you got. We cannot help you. But there are people that we can help. Then we'll go through a process. It might be a difficult process, but we'll fight to help you. That's what the doctor must make a decision. The Shomrei Torah, those that guard Torah, must also make that decision. There's certain people that they say, look, I can't help them, it's over with. There's certain people I can, and those I have to deal with. We're chapter 28, verse 5, and it says, evil people do not understand justice. And those that search for God understand everything. Okay? There are a few questions. One question is what do you mean they don't understand justice? You sit down and explain it to them, they can understand it. The second one is, why does it say those that search for God? It should be those that search for truth. The person that searches for truth is the person that searches for justice will find it. And what does it mean they'll understand everything? What is the everything? I mean, what are they going to become, rocket scientists? I mean, if the people that search for God are rocket scientists, not all of them. They don't know everything. What does it mean they know everything? Those are the questions that we have to answer. I would like to start with the one that searching for God. Those that search for God. The question is, when you're searching for God, the question is, how do you search for God? How do you find God? Where do you look when you're searching for God? We're talking about people searching. So the question is, where do you go looking? Where do you go looking for God? Searching for God is searching in God's universe, God's world. And the only way you could find God in the universe is through the concepts and ideas of the universe, where you see a system and you understand how the system works. There's two parts. There's seeing a system, that there is a system, but there's a certain order, and then to understand how the system works. Okay? Now therefore, so when you're searching for God, so therefore you start seeing that you must see systems. Once you recognize that everything must work by a system, you start recognizing that the human condition, the human social life, must be also a certain system. And therefore you must realize that the perfection of the society and the perfection of the individual human is his understanding of all types of systems plus the social system that keeps the society together. And when you recognize that just like when you look at the stars, the purpose of the stars is to understand how each star explains astronomy or physics or the universe, so each person represents a part of the social fiber, and each part must do his job. And when you understand how they operate together as a unit, then you understand justice. That's the understanding of justice, you see. So it's because he comes through the principles and order and system of the universe and the world and the different sciences, so also he recognizes and he looks for systems he recognizes naturally that there must be a just system in the social fiber too. The way the social life is made up, it must be just. While evil people, where do they start from? They start from themselves. What their desires are, and they create a system of justice based on their feelings and based on the particulars of their particular needs, not as a system of an overall picture. Because of that, they can never understand justice, you see. While the person that looks for the system will understand everything about justice. In other words, their subject is justice, and there's different aspects to justice. There's the consequences of not living a just life, the benefit for the society, the benefit for the individual of being a just person. What is the benefit of being a just person for the individual? They understand everything about justice because they're searching and trying to understand. In other words, a scientist tries to understand the system and how everything works out. If there's any contradiction, he tries to understand the different aspects of that contradiction. So therefore, he understands every aspect of justice. Or when something happens, if we hope from God, and something happens in the physical world, we have a why. Why do things work this way? Whether it's the laws of nature or God is intervening, it's still a question, why did God do it this way? So he understands that aspect of justice. He'll understand God's justice because he'll understand how the system works and how all these things work. So he'll understand all aspects of justice. While the wicked person is only interested in the self, and so he only looks at other people via his own needs. And therefore his whole idea of justice is based on his own desires. That is what the pasuk means. Okay, we're doing Mishlei Perek Chavches. That's 28, verse 11. Okay, it says, "He who is wise in his own eyes is a wealthy man." Well, you got to translate it the other way. A wealthy man is wise in his own eyes, and a poor man that understands will investigate it. And a wealthy man is wise in his own eyes, and a poor man of understanding will investigate it. Okay, so the first question is what is the it? We don't know what the it is yet. Okay, the second question is, what is there about a wealthy man that makes him think he is wise? What is that? What is the quality? Alright, the quality why a person feels that he's wise is because he's successful. Success emotionally makes you feel that there's something special about you. A person will not investigate if the success came about despite himself from outside factors or because he worked it out, which is a difference.
Well, success is
circumstantial. The question that Moshe asked is like this. He says that if you see a wealthy person, now there's no cause and effect that he became wealthy through wisdom or through knowledge, but however there's definitely a correlation between the two. In other words, you can't say that if a person is rich that he's not wise. He might have thought it out and worked it through. There are people that are wealthy despite their shortcomings, and there are people that are wealthy that worked it out with a certain degree of knowledge and understanding, and they worked out their business ideas in an intelligent way, and therefore they are wealthy, which shows a certain amount of knowledge that they have. So the question is, what is the pasuk talking about when it says a rich man that he is wise in his own eyes? What is the verse talking about? The answer is that there are two possibilities of what it means he's wise in his own eyes. One possibility is that we're only talking about a person that he was successful, even though he doesn't know really the ways of business, and he's not really a thinker, he didn't work it out, but he was successful by chance. That, and the Pasuk is only talking about that type of person. That's the first possibility. There is another possibility. The second possibility is that sometimes when a person is successful in a certain area, he believes that he's wise in all areas, and he starts becoming an authority in other areas. Success makes you feel that I'm wise, I'm successful, it gives me a lot of positive qualities which I really don't have. So when it says that he's wise in his own eyes, one possibility it could be in his wealth itself. In the wealth itself, he might have not made the money through ideas, through knowledge, and therefore he's faking himself out and he says, look how smart I am. On the other hand, it also could mean that he was successful because he thought it through, but then he thinks he'll give you advice in other areas too. People come to wealthy people in other areas and they think they're smart beyond where their capabilities are, and that is the quality of success. The next question is, so that's the Chacham Be'enav. There's two possibilities. One is in money he made a mistake, or two is he really is successful, he knows how to think about money, but he starts thinking that because he's successful that I am a great thinker, see I know how to work things out, and he goes into areas that is not his. Now the question, what is the it when it says that a poor man who understands investigates it? What is that? What's the it? So Akiva wants to say that what the it is that the poor person investigates. Right, so Akiva wants to say that when it says he investigates it, he investigates whether according to the way we understand the pasuk, is whether his success is based on his own understanding, or whether his success is based on outside factors. That's according to the first explanation. According to our second explanation, they investigate what is his field and what is not his field. So he will act based on his own field, but he won't act based on the field that he doesn't know. They'll ask a person that's in that field, he will ask questions of that person. And let's say, for instance, he's smart in money, but he doesn't know medicine, so he won't give advice about medicine or about other things in life. Okay? So therefore he knows what field he's successful, and that is the it. Okay? Alright. You guys remember last time we were doing chapter 28, verse 11, and we said that a rich man is wise in his own eyes, and a poor man of understanding will investigate it. Okay? And we said the reason why he is wise in his own eyes because of success. We said success, people do not analyze the situation, they just go by success, and they feel there's something special about them that they're successful. Well, we said that he investigates it, is that he investigates whether the success that he has or doesn't have is because of outside factors or because of himself. In other words, the rich man, there's a person that feels success, just feels, I'm a successful guy, somehow it has to do with me, personally. The intelligent person investigates the phenomenon whether his failure or his success is based on himself, that he made mistakes and therefore now it's time to correct those mistakes, to investigate them and correct them, or it's out of his hands. Something happened. The economy broke and he became poor. That's it. Okay? So he investigates. Okay. Now, some of the commentaries also learn this verse as a metaphor. The metaphor is talking about a man that has a good IQ, good intelligence, is wise in his own eyes, and a poor man, in other words, he doesn't have this great intelligence, but he has understanding, he investigates it. What is, according to the metaphor, what does the verse say? That's the question. I think the verse is saying the similar thing. The slightly different. One is that what you feel success about, everybody is different, and some people attach their success for one thing or another. Sometimes it's like, without the metaphor, it's something you acquire, because you have money, somehow you're great. Or if you have a good mind, so a person feels, I'm something special, because I have a good mind, I get great grades, and so therefore I'm better, and therefore I'm successful. I'm a great person. But however, an intelligent person investigates the ideas, you see. He might not have a great mind, and he can't even investigate abstract ideas. But every idea that he investigates thoroughly. Every step until the idea is real to his mind, not just that he accepts it, but it's real to his mind. You see, that is a difference between two types of people. Some people just, accept that I'm great. It's the same thing, the same emotion of success. Success fakes you out, and you have a certain feeling that I'm something special when you have success. It has been the destruction of many, many people. Many great tyrants, when they felt very successful, that was the beginning of their failure. You see? So success just says there's something special about me. You know what I mean? So therefore, I'm something special. Whatever the thing is. The same people, like, for instance, feel they're by religion. I'm a very religious person, and God protects me. I have a special protection from God, you see? So, that's also, how do you know? You know what I mean? They just have that feeling that somehow I'm totally protected and guided by God. You see, any type of success that a person feels, he's controlled, that he's something special, and things happen to him, that is a chacham be'enav. He's wise in his own eyes, successful in his own eyes. Something, he thinks he's smart, but the thing is that's usually a beginning of destruction. Because the thing is, they don't really analyze things, they don't really investigate things, and therefore they fail. They fail, because they don't really investigate the situation correctly. But however, a poor person, even though he might have failed, because of outside factors, but he understands exactly why he failed. He understands what the cause is to the best of his ability. He understands the situation. So he knows what he did correctly and what he did incorrectly and what he has to correct. You see? He's thorough. But even on the example of God, even in his relationship to God, he realizes he has to investigate that too. That in itself is an investigation. Where God helps, how God helps. You understand? So therefore even that needs an investigation. So therefore, that is what the pasuk is saying. Verse 13 says, if somebody covers his sins, he will not be successful. And he who admits and leaves them, Yeruchem, it will have a mercy. Okay, mercy will be on him. And the question is, who will have mercy on him? The verse doesn't say. Okay? So once again, he who hides his sins will not be successful. He who admits his sins and leaves them, mercy, he will have mercy on him. Okay? One possibility is that if he hides his sins, he will feel tremendous guilt. You understand? He will feel guilt over this, and he'll be in terrible conflict. Well, a person that just recognizes it, I don't know if he admitted publicly or not, that's a separate question that we have to ask, you know. But according to what you're saying, he would recognize it, and he leaves it, so then he would remove that guilt, to remove the pain of the guilt, so he's really having mercy on himself by recognizing it and undoing it and dealing with it, so it'll help remove the guilt. That's a good possibility.
Right.
The Rabbah learns two possibilities. One of the possibilities that he's different from anybody else, that other people will have mercy on him when they recognize that he repented, that he changed his ways. Other people will have mercy on him. We didn't understand the Rabbah, that point of the Rabbah, because from what we see, most people are usually either not forgiving or they do forgive. It's not based on reality. Unless you're talking about a person that lives the life of Mishlei, that is guided totally by the true ideas, so that person, when he sees a person changes, he recognizes and accepts that now he's a different person. Because he looks at life differently, but the average person doesn't look at reality. So the average person either is this type of person that always forgives, or is a person that never forgives, or the forgiveness is based on superficial things. You see? So if he's talking about a person from Mishlei, so yeah, those people from Mishlei would forgive. You know, that's a chacham, and recognize that a person has weaknesses and he makes mistakes and now he changes. That's it. Doesn't take it personally. Most people don't operate that way. So we're not sure. I mean, that's the only way. It's only if it's in line with a very high-level person. The third possibility that a lot of the Mefarshim mentioned, including the Rabbah, but others also mention it, that God will have mercy on him, because God, in other words, the verse is talking about repentance altogether. That if he sins, God will not accept him. But however, if the guy repents, even though he did sin, God will have mercy on him. And of course, if he covers up his sins, that's our third interpretation, right? And so the question is, according to the third interpretation, what does it mean, lo yatzliach, he will not be successful? I mean, it really means God will not accept him. It doesn't mean he won't be successful. Non-success means like something in the physical world, he'll fail because he has faults. Since he has faults, he'll fail, and therefore he'll fail in the physical world. Then the second half of the verse, that God has mercy on him, would also not fit in. In other words, if he's doing like a sin against God, or against he lives an irrational life, or you know what I mean, or he doesn't keep mitzvahs, so then I understand that he's sinning against God. But why? I mean, not success has to do with practical, and therefore the question is, when he admits and he leaves it, who will have mercy on him? Unless the verse is saying that he will, it is two things that happen. One is he'll fail in the physical world, and two, God will not forgive him. You see? God will not have mercy on him. Okay? That could be. We are doing chapter 28, verse 15 and 16. The pasuk says, when a lion growls and a bear, I'm sorry, the lion roars When a lion roars and a bear growls, that is like a evil ruler on a poor nation, and a leader that lacks a knowledge has a lot of desire for oppression. He oppresses, but however, he who hates wealth will live a long life.
And
when a lion roars and a bear growls, and an evil ruler on a poor is like an evil ruler on a poor nation. A leader that lacks knowledge has a lot of oppression towards his people, and he who hates profits, in other words, it's money by incorrect gains, evil gains. In other words, he takes money that is not his. In other words, he has a desire for money beyond the practical, will lengthen its days. Greed. We hate greed, the extra money, so they will live a long life. Just the last point I'd like to explain is talking about the nation. It's not talking about the leader. Could be talking about the leader also. That the leader will live a long life because, as we have to discuss. In other words, we're comparing leaders of the evil type of leader to a just type of leader in relationship to a nation. The first thing that we have to do is analyze the metaphor, okay? The lion roars after he killed the prey, brought down the prey. The dove growls, I think, when he goes on the attack. I think one of the commentaries say that. Okay? What he's saying is that the nature of these animals are to rip apart their prey. Okay? And to kill their prey. Okay? That is the reason why he gave the metaphor. Why did you say that the evil king wants to destroy his people? But what he's saying with the metaphor, just like it's the nature of the lion and the bear to destroy and to kill, they're doing it for food, but that's its nature, so is the nature of the evil person to destroy. The difference between the animal and the evil leader is the animal does it for practical reasons, while the leader does it just for his aggressive and sadistic impulses. Okay, that happens to be true. He just does it. But what the reason why they brought the metaphor is to tell us that it's the nature of evil to do this. It is the nature of evil, of power. When you have power, it's the nature of power to do this. Okay, to destroy others. Not all people that have power become evil. That's why the second half of the verse talks about Sone Betza, he who hates prophets beyond reality. That type of person doesn't become evil. That type of person will do what is just for the nation. Okay? But however, the evil person that just does it for gain, at a certain point, he will do it just out of evil. Just because of his nature, the nature of the human being, he will slowly remove all the layers of this character and do only that which is basic desire to destroy and to harm others. That's its basic nature of evil. That's what King Solomon is saying. The basic nature of evil, the basic nature of power brings out evil, and it starts with gain. I mean, every tyrant wants to own more land. He goes into, he wants more, he wants control. That's all power. He constantly wants more. He is never, ever satisfied, and it reaches the point where he is totally where he removes all facades and he reaches the point of total evil, where he just harms people for no reason. Like, for instance, by Saddam Hussein, he has money coming in from oil, and instead of helping his people, he built palaces. He built weapons of destruction. But however, he doesn't do anything to help the people. If anybody says anything about anything that he even thinks that it's wrong, he tortures them to death. The thing is that everything must be exactly his way. If you're slightly off, then that's it, then you're dead. It's totally, he's aggressive, I mean, he enjoys the evil. It reaches a point, the tyrant reaches a point where he actually enjoys harming people and destroying people. That's its nature. That's why it gave the metaphor of the lion. It's true, the lion and the bear, its nature is to destroy, but it's for a purpose, for food. But however, they were trying to say that the basic nature of evil is in a human being, and all the facades of civilization are removed through power. Okay, so therefore, it brings out the worst in a person. The only thing that could save a person is knowledge, when he realizes the harm of that type of life before he gets involved in it. Therefore, it says a leader that lacks knowledge, the knowledge of Mishlei, the knowledge of consequences of what he is doing, will be a person that oppresses his nation. He has a poor nation, there is no value. Rich nation, at least he has power, like if you're a king of a wealthy nation, you have power. Here there's nothing, but there's nothing to gain, and he still enjoys the evil and the harm that he could bring upon his own people. You see, it must be that way. The only thing that could stop you is knowledge. That knowledge will start where you start hating money that comes ill-gotten gains. You're not against money. Money is a practical thing. A person must make money and have a living. But however, if he does work for money, the leader, he'll do it for his nation and try to help his nation become out of poverty. You see? But however, the power, but if you don't have that knowledge, then all facades of civilization, of being civilized, as you get power, will be removed, until the basic evil that is in the human being you'll bring out and totally become this type of person, even though right now you cannot believe that that it's even humanly possible to be such a person. Like, how is it possible for a human being to be this bad? You can't even imagine it. But without knowledge, this what you can't imagine can happen given the right circumstances. It can happen. You could solely remove the facade of a civilization, of being civilized, and the base emotions will come out. And the base emotions will be evil. You see? That's what King Solomon is saying. But the only thing that can help you is knowledge, not your conscience. Some people, the conscience is only a facade, the cover-up of the base instincts. Okay? But however, that facade can be removed. Just given the right circumstances, they can be removed. The only thing that can protect you is the truth and reality of the consequences of your actions. You see? That's what the Pasuk is saying. That's what the Pasuk is saying. I mean, the base emotions is egocentricity, where you look cross-eyed at me, I torture you to death. And it's power, more power, and there's a certain sadistic, the base emotion, there's sadism, where somebody is under your control, you desire to harm. Which is, even these people that are there, that that your whole government is dependent on them, you desire to harm them, because that's the nature of evil. All you have to do is remove the facade.